So a father was having devotions with his two little girls, and what he was doing was teaching them the Ten Commandments. Each week, he focused on a different commandment, what he called God's rules. And so after a few weeks, he decided that he would test his daughters to see how well they were learning the Ten Commandments. Now, his five-year-old did all right. She got each one of them. So feeling pretty confident about his teaching abilities, he then went to his three-year-old. Morgan, he said, what rules do you remember? And Morgan thought about it long and hard, and then she said, don't chew on things. Okay, that's a pretty good rule, Morgan, but can you remember any of God's rules?
And she pondered the question, thought about it, and then she said with a smile, don't write on the walls. Well, humbled but not defeated, the father put his teacher's ego on the line once again and said, those are both very good rules, honey, but can you remember any of God's rules? You know, the ones we've been talking about each night. Little Morgan scrunched up her face deep in thought. And then suddenly a light came on. Hello, contact. And she pulled herself up to her full 36 inches of stature and proudly announced, put your gum into twash. Well, since then, the father's made a lot of progress, and so has Morgan. And so now, whenever he asks if she can remember any of God's rules, the first one she always names is no other gods. Now, there's a lot left in this life that little Morgan has to learn. And though she is brand new to the world of ethics and morality, she's already grasped the most fundamental truth that anyone could ever understand. And that is that absolutely nothing in our lives is to take priority over God, right? We are to have, as Morgan puts it, no other gods. The first commandment is that our Creator demands first place. He alone deserves that spot, and he will accept no other position. As God said through Isaiah, I am the Lord, that is my name. I will not give my glory to another. But why? Why does God insist on being number one? And why does he begin this series of the most basic rules of ethics and morality, these fundamental principles of a free and civilized society with this principle of having no other gods? So let's unpack this idea. And the first thing that we need to understand is this, that we will have gods. We will have gods. Notice the first commandment doesn't say you must believe in God. The wording of the commandment assumes that we already believe in some God, right? You will have no other gods before me. It's not a question of whether you believe in something or someone or not, right? But it's a question of which God do you believe in? And the fact is that every single human being has a God or gods. Every person by nature will place our trust and our allegiance in something outside of ourselves, right? We were created with this dependency, this God-shaped hole, all right? And we have this void in our lives and we will fill it with something. Roddy Bullock points out that everyone believes in something that is unbelievable, Christians and atheists alike, right? Whether you believe in creation or abiogenesis, right? Is it not more incredible to believe that the universe sprang into existence all by itself from nothing than it is to believe that it was created by an eternal God? We all believe in something that provides some sort of guiding principle for our lives, right? No one lives their life as though life doesn't matter. Right? Everyone believes that their words and their actions amount to something. Right? They have some sort of meaning and purpose. Right? If there is truly no God, then nothing that you say or do will make any slightest difference over the long run. If there is no God, there is no ultimate source of right and wrong. There is no sense of oughtness to the universe. And if there is no ultimate source of right and wrong, if there is no sense of oughtness to this universe, then there is no functional difference between, say, eating a bar of chocolate and going on a killing spree. Because there's nothing to say that, well, one is good and one is wrong. I mean, after all, we're just one random group of molecules interacting with other random groups of molecules, and there is nothing to give it meaning or purpose. But if you believe that love means something, that kindness matters, that splendid sunset should be enjoyed, that good coffee should be savored, that life should be treasured, that colors arranged just so on a canvas, or that three chords played in a certain order can move you, all right? If you believe that justice is important, that good should triumph over evil, then why? What gives any of those things any meaning? What does any of it matter at all anyway? Theologian G. Campbell Morgan puts it this way: it is impossible for a man to live without having an object of worship, as it is for a bird to fly if it is taken out of the air. The very composition of human life, the mystery of man's being, demands a center of worship as a necessity of existence, right? All of life is worship, he writes. The question is whether the life and powers of man are devoted to the worship of the one true God or to that of a false one. Now, maybe you're thinking, well, of course he thinks that. He's a Christian. He's a theologian. Well, how about this quote from Frank Zappa, who says, "Everybody believes in something, and everybody, by virtue of the fact that they believe in something, uses that something to support their own existence." Now, this worship may or may not be religious. It may involve rituals or not. It doesn't really matter, because every life will have something around which everything else revolves. Thus, even atheists worship a God. Right? Now, they may not engage in religious rituals, but they worship a God nonetheless, whether it's the God of self, or human progress, or education, or politics, or pleasure, right? Your God is whatever has first place in your life, right? It's whatever sits on the throne of your heart. Every heart has a throne. That's a given. But who or what is on that throne? That's the million-dollar question. And what God is saying here in the first commandment is, I and only I, no one else should be on that throne. Well, why? Why should it only be God on that throne? All right, well, this brings us to our second point that we need to unpack this morning. And that is this: your God, right, whatever sits on the throne of your heart, your God determines the direction of your life, right? Your God determines the direction of your life. We will all have a God, and the course of our entire lives is determined by that God. Everything in our life flows from whatever or whomever is on the throne of our hearts. Our decisions, our goals, our desires, our motives flow from whatever has first place in our hearts. Character begins with belief. Let me say that again. Character begins with belief. Now, we've been trying very hard in recent decades in our country to deny that reality. We've been living with this illusion that we can have good morals and good ethics without God. The problem is that when we erase God from the picture, we'll put a false God on the throne, often without realizing that that's what we've done. But whatever that false God may be, it then determines our ethics and our morality. Consider lying, right? If your God is self, then lying is going to be often justified because it protects the self. But if our God is the true God, the absolute supreme being, the creator and sustainer of the universe, then, and he says, I want you to be a person of truth and integrity. You shall not bear false witness. Then all of a sudden, our motivation for integrity and truth becomes something greater. If our God is material possessions and accumulating more and more stuff, right? Well, then we will covet, right? Because coveting our neighbor's things will feed that God. If our hearts are ruled by greed and desire for money, then we're not going to object too strongly to stealing because, well, greed is, if only for a moment, satisfied. If sexual pleasure is on the throne of our hearts, then obviously we will lust, all right? We will lust after our neighbor's wives. We will commit adultery and all kinds of sexual immorality, all to serve that God. You see, there's no way that you can separate morality from our worship. And so this is why God includes in the Ten Commandments both our duty to God and our duty to others in one set of commandments. And this is also why our duty to God has to come first, right? Because none of us choose our God based upon our morals, right? We don't say to ourselves, for instance, well, I'm going to live my life in such and such a way, and I'm going to have these morals and these ethics, so I'm going to go out and find a God who fits that. No, that's not what we do. We do the opposite. We determine our morals by whatever our God is, right? So you can begin to see why God says, you shall have no other gods before me. Now, contrary to popular belief, any workable system of morals and ethics has to begin at this point, or it'll be worthless. Several years ago, there was a group of college professors who gave their students copies of the Ten Commandments, and then he asked them to arrange the Ten Commandments in order of importance. And 90% of the students reversed the commandments, all right? They put all the commandments having to do with interpersonal morality and our relations with other people first, while they put all the commandments dealing with our relationship with God last. And this is reflective of our culture's idea that what's really important in our character is how we treat other people. You know, faith is only this ethical side dish. But God says no, right? Your faith, your belief, your love for God, that's the most central component of who we are, right? We can't leave God out of the equation or everything will begin to fall apart. Now, Satan wants to convince us otherwise. He tries to convince us that we are the moral center. And often he succeeds with this task, right? Consider how we often or have long tried to teach sexual morality to our young people, right? We have tried to convince our youth that they need to remain sexually pure for marriage, right? Now, this is certainly a part of God's plan. But then look at the reasons we give, right? This is what I was told. This is what I taught early in my ministry. But three reasons, right? Well, you might get a bad reputation. Number two, you might get a disease. You know, when I was a kid, it was STDs. Now it's STIs, right? You might get pregnant or cause a pregnancy. Number three. But got to realize that our world has a different God sitting on the throne. And so they've taken all three of those things and throwing them out the window. They don't matter. They're not relevant anymore. Because, like, no longer does sexual promiscuity bring a bad reputation. Right? Sometimes people brag about being a slut or having that kind of reputation. It's an accepted thing. You're not normal if you don't. All right. And as far as getting pregnant, well, now we have all sorts of contraceptions, you know, pills and condoms and other things they insert. I mean, it just goes on and on, patches you can wear. And if none of that works, well, then, well, you can have an abortion. It's a woman's right to choose. And now we've got amazing drugs that treat many of the most common STIs. So when you leave God out of the picture, solid morals cannot take hold. The highest motive for sexual purity is there is a holy and righteous God who calls us to purity. Right? Now, imagine all of the commandments as a stone archway. This first commandment is the top stone in the arch. It's what's called a keystone. It is the stone that keeps all the others in place. All of the other stones descend from it, find their stability from it, right? And you pull that stone out and they all fall down. This is why God's moral code begins here. Out of all of the competitors for the love of our hearts, God insists on being number one. He alone must sit on the throne. Let's talk about those thrones for a moment. This is our third point we're going to unpack today. Thrones are made for only one. If you ever go to Europe and tour ancient castles, one of the highlights of any tour is the throne room. All right. Now, thrones come in all shapes and sizes and styles. Some are quite extravagant, all right, laced in fine jewels, covered in gold, sprawling with intricate designs. Others are much more simple. All right. They're made out of wood or stone. All right. But there's one thing that's common to all these thrones, and that is they're made for one occupant. There's no such thing as a throne pew. The same is true of the throne of our hearts. It is designed for only one. And the one for whom it is designed is the Lord God himself. Now, humanity for centuries has been trying to place all kinds of other things on that throne, but they don't fit. They don't belong, right? It is shaped for Jehovah alone. Everything else is like trying to put a square peg into the proverbial round hole. One thing we've got to remember about all of these commandments is that God actually made them for our benefit. In each and every rule, God is protecting and providing for us. And prohibiting all other gods to us, God is offering us the greatest gift of all, himself. So when we read, "You shall have no other gods," there is an implied, "You shall have me. I will be your God. I will have an intimate relationship with you. I will love you. I will receive your love. I will look out for you. I will care for you." And this is a tremendous grace because God is offering himself, right? It's like the king that who went out into the streets and he sought out all of the beggars and he reaches his hands out to them and he lifts up their chin and he looks into their eyes. And he says, "No longer do I want you to eat from the crumbs that fall into the gutters. Come, feast from my banquet table. Satisfy yourself with the choicest meats, the most exquisite pastries, the finest, choicest wines. The best that I have is yours to enjoy." It's no loss to give up crumbs for a feast. And before God ever gives this first command, he introduces himself. "I am the Lord your God. I, not it." Right? God is a personal being. He is alive. He is not an impersonal force, an inanimate principle, or an inert idea. And as a personal God, he can care. He can love. He can be loved. I am the Lord. Now, the word Lord here in the Hebrew is Yahweh. This is the personal name for God. This is the name that God revealed to Moses at the burning bush. When Moses says, well, who should I tell Pharaoh that sent me? And God says, I am that I am. I am Yahweh. That's what Yahweh means. He is the God who always is, right? Whenever and wherever you are, God is. He's never outdated. He's never out of touch. He is always relevant. He was the God of the Hebrews in the 13th century BC. He's the God of the 21st century. He is still I am. He never will be. He was. I am the Lord your. And the word your in Hebrew, this is interesting, is in the singular, right? This isn't a plural your. This isn't the whole group. This is an individual your. He is our God intimately and personally. He is our God face to face and heart to heart. He knows us individually. He wants us to love him individually. And we must approach God in a personal relationship. It means nothing to say, well, that he was the national God of Israel, or that America was founded on Christian principles, or that you were raised in a Christian family, or your spouse is a believer. No, that doesn't matter. He wants to be your God. I am the Lord your God. Now, the final word here, this is the title that Jews use to identify God in his supreme power. He is the ruler. He is the one with absolute authority. He is the one for whom the throne is made. He deserves our worship and devotion. He is worthy of our service. And we rightfully belong to him. And we owe all to him. God is not asking anything that isn't rightfully his. He is our creator, our designer, our protector, our helper, right? He is no imposter or wannabe. Now, there's only one true God who deserves to sit on the throne of our hearts. Oh, but there are many other would-be kings who would be more than happy to sit on that throne. Many competitors for our hearts that Satan would be thrilled if he could place them on your throne. And no, we don't have idols carved out of wood and metal and stone today. But we do have cars fabricated out of steel and aluminum. We have houses built out of brick and board. And they can certainly fill the same spot that any idol ever did. And I don't know anyone who worships Mars, the god of war, but there are certainly those who place their highest trust in the military might of the United States. Their god is America's ability to outgun every other military force in the world. And you can drive all over town, and I don't think you'll find a temple to Epaphrodite, the sex goddess, but there are so many who worship sex in the pursuit of the latest sensual thrill, and our coins which say, in God we trust. If we were being honest, they probably would say, in this God we trust. The truth is, there are many competitors for our hearts. And our gods, they range from family to career to cars to houses to golf to football, right? We've even got some false gods in the church. We might worship a particular speaker or an author. We might worship a particular style of worship. So how do we keep God number one in ourselves, right? And how do we know for sure that we've given him first place? Well, let me give you a helpful acronym. FIRST, F-I-R-S-T. Now, F is for focus. Where is the focus of your life? See, most people don't start out by just simply denying God, but they slowly lose sight of him over time. It is easy to lose our focus. was a lady leaving church one Sunday, and she saw her friend, and she asked her friend, she says, "Did you notice the hat Myrtle was wearing?" "No, I didn't notice," her friend replied. "Well," the first woman tried again, "what about that coat that Hazel had on? Did you see that?" "No, I really didn't notice either." "Well," the woman harumped, "a lot of good it does you to go to church." But having focus involves much more than what we think about on Sunday mornings while we're at church. What occupies our minds, our thoughts, throughout the week? Do you realize that who you are today is the product of your thoughts yesterday? Think about that. As we think, so we become. All right? See this right here between your ears? This is the greatest spiritual battlefield. And where and how we focus our mind is of utmost importance. The Apostle Paul writes in Philippians 4:8, he says, "Whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there is anything excellent or anything worthy of praise, let your mind dwell." Right? Focus on these things. So F is focus, I is income. All right. One of the best ways to measure your character is to see how you measure your money. All right, your bank account, your credit card statements are probably the greatest indicators of what is truly on the throne of your heart, because your money follows your faith. Your money finds its way to whatever is most important to you. Jesus made this point in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So F is focus, I is income, R is relationships. Relationships. How we love others, how we treat others says a lot about how we love God. 1 John 4:7-8 says, "Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love." Our relationships can reveal what's on the throne of our hearts. And you can tell a lot about a person by the company they keep. See, if God is in first place in our hearts, then all of our relationships will fall into one of two categories. All right? Number one, the people that we choose to be around because they bring us closer to God. And number two, the people we choose to be around because we can bring them closer to God. Now, I realize that we all have maybe people in our family or people we work with that we simply have to be around that don't fall into those two categories. But here's something you need to consider. If your life is filled with significant relationships that pull you further from God, there's something not right in your heart. Right? It's a warning sign that there is something or someone else sitting on the throne. So focus, income, relationships, and S, security. Security. What is your source of security? Right? Where do you go when you need help? What do you lean on for support? Where do you turn first? Remember Linus and Peanuts, right? He always had his blanket. It was always with him. And I always found it odd because Linus was probably the smartest of the Peanuts gang, but he still had to hang on to his security blanket. Well, we all have security blankets, right? Now, your security blanket might be burying yourself in your work, all right? You run from home, you run from problems in relationships, you run from God and just become all consumed with work. Your security blanket might be shopping, all right? When the anxiety level gets cranked up to 11, all right, you whip out the credit card and you head to the store, or you go onto Amazon for a little retail therapy. Your security blanket might be food or drink. It might be a habit. Whenever it comes to security, too often we turn to something else first, and God is our last resort, right? We're like the man who's lying in a hospital bed and the doctor comes in with the bad news and he says, "I'm afraid all we can do now is pray." "Oh, dear, the patient responded. Has it come to that? You see, when God is our first priority rather than our last resort, we can do what Peter says in 1 Peter 5, 7. Cast all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. Now, so you've got focus, income, relationships, security, and the T. And first is for time. All right, time. And perhaps as revealing as our bank account is our calendars. All right. What do we make time for? Now, if it's important to us, we're going to find time for it. We can make it to work every day. We can make it to our practices and our games and our activities. But sometimes church only makes it on the schedule when there's nothing else planned. When I was growing up, my parents laid down a very simple rule for me, and this is something I followed the rest of my life. But it was, I could be involved in whatever sports or clubs or activities I wanted to, so long as it did not interfere with church activities. All right. And they even had some leniency in this. They said, you will be in church on Sunday morning. All right. That's non-negotiable. And you will be in church either Wednesday night or Sunday evening. All right. You can let your boss pick one or the other, but you will be in one of those things. And if there was anything, whether it was work or school activity or sports that interfered with that, all right, it was the other thing that got abandoned. All right. And I think far too many Christian families are giving first place to school and activities and jobs, right? And church comes only when it's convenient, all right? God is only given time when there's nothing else on the schedule. And let me believe you, right? Believe me, I mean, your job doesn't care about your spiritual life, not unless you're blessed with a very Christian boss. But your job doesn't care, right? The school system doesn't care about your spiritual life, doesn't care about your relationship with God. They will be more than happy to schedule activities during youth group. They're going to be more than happy to schedule things on a Sunday morning. All right? You have to choose what sits on the throne. Don't let somebody else choose for you. But time with God, it's more than just one or two days a week, all right? This isn't just about church and church attendance, all right? We've got to give him time every day. Suppose that I said to my beautiful wife, I said, hey, honey, I want you to know that I am going to be absolutely, totally, completely faithful to you one day a week. No, I mean it. That day is yours. I promise I will not be with any other women on that day. Do you think she would be pleased with that arrangement? How about God? Do you think he likes that arrangement? And even then, it's not a day. It's like a couple hours, one morning. So does God have first place in your life? Is he sitting on the throne of your heart? If not, what is sitting on your throne? You need some really honest self-assessment here. Maybe there's some idols that need to be toppled. Right? Is God number one, or have you put other gods before him? All right. Know this. He alone is worthy. Thank you. And God bless.